Get ready for Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by TruPrep. For all your prepping needs, visit TruPrep online at truprep.com or visit a TruPrep store in Roswell or Marietta. Listen in as Doug and Amy provide helpful tips on how to get ready for anything that comes your way. And now, your hosts, Doug and Amy.
Welcome, everybody. You're listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. This week, we're going to be talking a little bit about earthquakes, volcanoes, and the Ring of Fire. We've had a plethora of geologic activity happening out on the West Coast and all the way around the Pacific Coast, including in Japan and Singapore and nations around the edge of what's called the Ring of Fire. And I think that this is a very timely topic. What really got me thinking about talking about how to prepare for an earthquake or a volcanic eruption has been all of the news coming out of Yellowstone in the last 10 days, where I've seen these videos of the bison fleeing the park, just running down the freeway away from the park, and you are seeing birds leaving. And it's very reminiscent of that scene in the movie 2012, where they had the super volcano erupt in Yellowstone, and you saw all the animals leaving. I mean, right before the eruption, all the birds took off and started flying away. And, you know, I believe that animals do have kind of a sixth sense about geologic and seismic and weather activities that we are not tuned into. You know, birds migrate. They follow geomagnetic patterns in their migration. They just seem to have this ability to forecast things that human beings, being as detached as we are from nature, no longer possess.
Yeah, it's a telltale sign, I think, Doug, when... You know, and that's before all the electronics and the computer programs and things that, heck, even before electricity, that's how modern man, you know, knew that something was coming. I mean, you could tell by the flight of the birds.
You could feel it in your bones, too.
I think people were more in tune also, not just the animals, but I think, you know, we as a human race were a lot more in tune to nature and our surroundings, and we've lost a lot of that.
They say that if you go camping for 10 days without any electronics, so that your biological clock resets along to when the sun is rising and setting, and that it resets your REM sleep patterns to be in the darkest part of the night, and it's more healthy for you. Of course, I don't know how healthy it would be for me if, you know, I reset to getting up at, you know, 9 o'clock when the sun comes up, or right? might not be the healthiest thing career wise, but you know, when you're away from all that, it kind of resets the batteries. I remember reading in The Stand by Stephen King that same kind of idea that, you know, we're like a big old Cadillac with the air on and the GPS running and the radio on full blast and cruise control and everything, and the poor battery just can't hardly keep up. But when you turn it all off, then that big old alternator kicks in and the battery charges up like nothing and is fully ready to go, because it's not having all of these draws. And the TV and the internet and the cell phones and the alarm clocks and the iPods and the iPads and the everything.
And it's getting worse.
It just drains your energy from inside of you, not just outside of your battery, but it drains you to be a part of that system. That's not what we were meant to be. And so we've lost touch with what the animals feel when it comes to these, you know, seismic vibrations. And to see all of these animals fleeing the park has renewed a lot of speculation about the Yellowstone super caldera. If the super volcano let loose in Yellowstone, what would it mean? And there is, I saw some stuff on the Discovery Channel and on PBS. Everybody's talking about what would this mean. Because I think most people are familiar with the idea of a volcano. You've got the volcanoes in Hawaii, you've got volcanoes in Mexico, you see a lot of volcanoes active in Alaska. You know, there it's a mountain that occasionally smokes, it occasionally rumbles. Once in a while you see some really impressive looking lava come off of it. I think people remember the volcanic eruptions in Iceland a couple of years ago, which shut down some airplane traffic in and out of Europe. And it was a big deal because everyone was talking about, well, there's ash in the air and that you can't have, you know, airplanes flying through the ash. Well, people don't realize that this ash is thousands of microscopic little rocks that are floating in the atmosphere, and they're sharp as all get out. So these little tiny razor blades are flying through the air, and when they get sucked into a jet engine, they shred it. And the thing goes down like a ton of bricks. So you cannot fly if there's atmospheric ash from a volcanic eruption. But the ash is a lot more than that. The ash causes mud flows called lahars. The ash will get into your breathing and it'll utterly destroy you. The ash is very, very dangerous. And it's something that a lot of people don't think of because they see the eruption as being lava. Mm-hmm. And that's what they're afraid of. And they're like, well, you know, I don't live near anything that's going to spew lava out on me. So what does it matter? But it's a global thing when there's a huge volcanic eruption. And the volcano in Yellowstone is not like any volcano we're thinking of. Where this thing is something, you know, a normal eruption might affect hundreds of square miles. You know, when Mount St. Helens blew, do you remember Mount St. Helens?
I do, yeah.
Okay, tell me a little bit about the news stories. You know, the people that were being wiped out by the blast.
Remind me the year. When was that? Do you remember what year that was?
I think it was 1981.
81. Where was I in 1981? What?
The year I was born.
The year you were born.
So I'm stretching
81.
It. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. No, I think I was in middle school in 1981. I think I was.
Well, anyway, it was a major event. It was the first real volcanic eruption we had in the U.S. Mm-hmm. And people, I mean, the pictures of all the trees gone and everything, you think, well, you know, I don't live near a volcano. I don't even live near a dormant one, so mm-hmm. I don't have anything to worry about.
But we have Stone Mountain. I don't think we're too concerned about Stone Mountain blowing up.
At least not in that way.
No.
a super volcano is a 100,000 times bigger. We're not talking about a volcano that would wipe out a city. We're talking about a volcano that the blast radius would take out all of Montana.
Yeah, so this isn't like, you know, going on a trip to Hawaii and one of the little ventures that you could walk out and, you know, kind of tiptoe and sort of see a little bit of, you know, some of the red volcanic. I mean, you still have tourists out there. You can get pretty darn close to these things and see some activity. So we're not talking about that.
If Hawaii was a super volcano, the blast would impact with a tidal wave not only Japan, but also California.
Mm.
And Hawaii is the largest mountain on Earth. The main island there is much taller than Everest or Denali, which is really the tallest mountain on Earth. Everest sits on a plateau, so it's the highest above sea level, mm-hmm. but the actual height of the mountain is not as high as Denali in Alaska. Mm. From the ground around it. Anyway, those volcanoes, those are normal volcanoes, and they're moving. And that's the other kind of interesting thing, because the spot where the magma is coming up out of the crust is continually turning, so you get these hot spots, and that's why there's a chain of Hawaiian Islands, because it builds up, and then it slowly slides away, and it starts to build up a new one. And right now, over in Japan, there is a new island that is being formed by volcanic activity, and it's getting so large that it has swallowed up the neighboring island that was right next to it. Now, this is the same sort of thing. It's a conveyor belt chain of islands that are being constantly built by a magma crack down at the bottom of the ocean. So you would think that as the rotation stays relatively constant, each island would be relatively similarly sized. But this one is growing so fast that not only has it grown up to its normal proportions for its ahead of its time frame, but it's grown enough to absorb the other island next to it. So that shows that there's a real increase in geologic activity across the Pacific. We've had so many earthquakes this year. You know, we've heard stories of 5-point-something magnitude quakes out in California, in Venezuela, in Argentina. There have been earthquakes in Alaska. There have been earthquakes in Oregon. There have been more earthquakes in the first quarter of 2014 in Oklahoma than there were all of last year in Oklahoma.
Yeah, well, we just currently had one, a local earthquake.
Yes, we had one in North Carolina. We had one in Georgia, which are atypical. I mean, this is really atypical geologic behavior. Going back to Oklahoma, they had as many earthquakes as they had in 2013, just the first 4 months of this year. But they had as many earthquakes in 2013 as they had for the previous 15 years combined.
Well,
so it's a huge increase in geologic activity all around. So what does this mean? I mean, what would happen if Yellowstone let loose. I mean, this is something that, you know, it seems like it's a remote possibility. I mean, when was the last time that happened? Well, it happened about 600,000 years ago, mm-hmm. which is a fairly long time. I mean, even for me. But the scary part is that our best geologists say that it's due to erupt about every 400,000 years. Mm-hmm. So it's 200,000 years overdue for an eruption.
Right. And I'm kind of thinking, you know, off the top of my head, I'm thinking, okay, I don't live too close. So, you know, I'm even wondering if I should be concerned, you know, living out here in Georgia.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the blast radius mm-hmm. of a supervolcano and the effect zone. First off, the blast radius is going to take out almost all of Montana in a big circle. Now, Yellowstone is located kind of in the west central Montana region going down towards Wyoming. It would take out a big chunk of Wyoming, almost all of Montana. So imagine that as your first ring. And we'll put up a graphic of this on our website. But there's your first ring. Then you have, that's the part that actually is going to explode, have a crater, mm-hmm. and be gone. Outside of that, you have a blast radius, where just like a nuclear bomb going off, it's not necessarily the heat of the explosion that gets you. It's that, like a thunderclap, the air is pushed out for miles and miles around it. That second ring would take out a large portion of Canada, most of North and South Dakota, Nebraska, in a big circle going into Oregon and Washington State.
That's
where
big.
That's where the trees are all pushed flat mm-hmm. from the thunderclap that wow. knocks everything down. And increased heat temperatures as well.
Imagine what it would do to the buildings, I would imagine.
Yeah. Now, you know, some buildings probably would withstand it really well, things that are built for mm-hmm. seismic activity. But still, I mean, just that's just the pressure mm-hmm. wave. Then we have the ash. And the ash is going to create this kind of oblong shape moving as the wind blows towards the east. And the ash is going to completely cover most of Minnesota, Michigan, Illinois, Iowa, Nebraska, Oklahoma, Texas, and most of Mississippi and some of Alabama. That's where the heaviest ash is going to be. Then you have lighter ash where it's going to simply clog things like automobiles and cause the inability to run airplanes and things like that for most of the rest of the eastern seaboard going out to the Atlantic. In as little as 3 weeks, the ash will have completely encircled the Earth, and you will see a decrease in temperatures globally by as much as 10 degrees.
So this is the opposite of global warming,
yes.
I assume?
This would be global cooling, and you would have basically the fallout of a nuclear winter. It would be at the point where with a 10-degree drop in temperatures, you would see a massive amount of ice flows. There would be more glaciation than we have seen for the last 10,000 years. Large portions of Alaska, Canada, the Ukraine would be covered by snow.
All right. Well, Doug, this is interesting. I'll tell you what, let's take a quick break. We're going to jump back into this, and we're going to look at it from the perspective of emergency preparedness and that sort of thing. And I know we've got a lot more information. So you guys stick with us, and we'll be right back. You're listening to Ready Radio.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome, folks. You're listening to Ready Radio. We just finished up our last segment talking a little bit about the effects of supervolcanoes. And Amy and I were talking over the break and about, you know, what are you going to do to really be prepared for an event like this? I mean, there are so many different aspects. If you're close to a volcano or if you're anywhere near a supervolcano, you're going to have, it's going to be a devastating event. I mean, there's very little that somebody can do when the ground opens up and spews forth mm-hmm. thousands of degrees of hot melted rock. I mean, that's kind of hard to be ready for other than having an escape route and being aware that when there's any kind of warning signs like thousands of animals fleeing the area.
Exactly. But I mean, that's a good point, though, Doug. I mean, what do you do if you're in that spot? One of the things that I just preach is being ready to pick up and go. And, you know, I mean, there's a lot you can do just with spring cleaning and going through the stuff that you don't need and kind of putting things in an area that you know that you would, you know, you would grab and go in a situation. Because let me tell you, when you have you ever moved, Doug?
I've moved seven times in the last 20 months.
I laugh because I know this. I feel for you. My heart just bleeds for you.
And not
it's
just
not easy.
Not just moving across the street either. I had to put everything on a barge to go across the Pacific Ocean.
Yes, you did. Yeah. I mean, imagine if you could take maybe a quarter of what you owned and you had, you know, about 15 minutes to do it.
When I was first getting into preparedness, I did exactly what you're talking about. Mm-hmm. I decided to make up a go kit and to have the highest priority things, you know, the guns, the ammo, the medicine, everything that was high value and portable, ready to go. And one day we were going to have a exterminator come by the house, and I had made it clear that I wanted to know well in advance so we could load up the dogs and the kids and the cat and the stuff that mm-hmm. I didn't want anybody stealing while I wasn't in the house, and gather it all together, put it in the truck in a timely manner, and we'll go off to the in-laws' house for a little while. Great. So then I find out that the exterminator is on his way, and we have 1 hour before he'll get there. And I thought, you know,
it's good practice.
This is good practice. Yes. Let's load up the truck. And so in a mad panic, we loaded everything of value that we had onto the truck, including the animals and the kids, and we were out the door and on the road in 45 minutes.
Awesome. Pretty good.
45 minutes is way, way too long in a volcanic event.
In an event like this, yes.
I mean, you're going to have mm-hmm. 5 minutes mm-hmm. or maybe two
yeah.
minutes.
Yeah. And yeah, you really think, what would I grab in 2 minutes?
Yes.
You know, I mean, you have your computer with all your pictures that you have downloaded of your children. You know, and what about all the documents? I mean, my goodness, I have on my blog, I actually have, there is about a binder, and you could actually go and put all of your very important documents in this binder. You know, you can download things and put them on a disk. But I mean, it's all in one spot. So instead of having, you know, this, you know, file cabinet full of stuff, you have all the, you know, your most important documents in one spot.
One of the suggestions that the Cobb County District Attorney's Office offered at the Smyrna Preparathon event a couple of weeks ago was to take and make a photocopy of all of your important documents mm-hmm. and store them with a family member in a different state.
Yep, it's a great idea.
That way that it's always removed from whatever incident could be happening right. to you and yours.
And you can even take photos. I mean, you know, I know that insurance companies suggest that you go around your house and you take photographs of what you do have in case of a fire or a flood or something along those lines. And I mean, if you are in an area that you're concerned about, you know, one of these super volcanoes, I mean, I think that would be pretty top priority.
Yeah. And, you know, when we start to look at the broader picture, even the people who aren't in the blast zone, you know, there's the initial event zone, then there's the blast zone. Mm-hmm. But once you start talking about the ash, I mean, all that ash goes up in the atmosphere, and it's going to take a long time for most of it to come back down.
Well, tell me a little bit more about that, because, I mean, when I think ash, what I visualize is what's left over in my fireplace.
That's not the kind of ash that we're talking about.
Yep.
Volcanic ash is pulverized microscopic little bits of pumice, which is a very, very light volcanic rock. And if you've ever used lava soap, you know mm-hmm. what pumice is, because mm-hmm. it's very gritty. It has a lot of texture to it, but it's very, very lightweight. Pumice will float. You mm-hmm. can take a big old pumice rock and it'll float in water, and that floats in the atmosphere. Now think about, you know, breathing lava soap. The little bits of grit that's all throughout the atmosphere, it scours whatever it's introduced to. And volcanic ash is one of the best ways to make a solid rock concrete structure. You can use volcanic ash mixed with just plain water, and it will solidify into basically concrete. And think about what that will do to your lungs. Mm-hmm. This is so fine that every time you breathe, you will breathe it into your lungs. And the moment it touches your nice, wet, warm lungs, it will solidify into concrete inside your body.
Is this something you're able to sort of cough up?
No.
No.
No, you're in deep trouble, because it will not only be cutting up the insides of your lungs, but it will be solidifying into something hard and firm.
So is this something that that someone would have to wear, like a gas mask, or would something just as easy as like maybe a bandana wrapped around your mouth, would that even help?
Anything would help, but I think that you would really need a gas mask, because your filter rate is going to be negligible. Mm-hmm. That's one of the biggest problems, is that, you know, your filter only lasts as long as, you know, the immersion in media that it has. Mm-hmm. I have filters at my house for my water. Okay, I've got mm-hmm. a 5 micron, a 2.5, and a 1 micron filter. And they, you know, the water's going through there. I have a high iron content. Nobody thinks anything about it in the house until all of a sudden the water's gone.
Right.
The filter's clogged mm-hmm. and the water drops off instantly.
Mm-hmm.
Well, when you have this much ash that you're breathing and it's clogging up those filters, the filters are going to clog very quickly and your oxygen supply is going to just drop off.
Mm-hmm.
and that's really bad.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're going to have to get away from the main ash area, which means massive statewide evacuations towards the southeast, probably, because mm-hmm. we're as far away as you can get other than Alaska from the volcano, if the Yellowstone supervolcano were to go. So all of the people along the eastern seaboard would be fleeing towards Florida to get away from the ash. Hmm. It would be a truly devastating event for the entire nation, but also for the entire world. When Krakatoa went off, that's triggered a period called the Little Ice Age. And I know everyone has seen the pictures of Washington crossing the Delaware, you know, in school. Mm-hmm. You know, he's standing on the boat and there's a big chunks of ice. The Delaware River doesn't freeze. If you go to the Delaware River today, it mm-hmm. never freezes. Mm-hmm. But there were huge chunks of ice in 1776 because the Little Ice Age was in place. It was so cold that grapes were not growing in France. They had like 10 years of the worst wine production in history because the temperatures had just dropped off a cliff, and it was because of a volcanic eruption. Mm-hmm. And you would see that again. There would be glaciation across the entire north half of North America, and it would be, global temperatures would drop around 10 degrees. You would see water levels drop. The salinity of the ocean would increase because more fresh water would be captured in ice fields in the northern hemisphere and around Antarctica than is being pumped into the ocean. And more salinity in the oceans affects buoyancy for ships, and it affects the animal life and more, how far they can live and how deep they can go. I mean, it would change whole ecosystems.
Yeah, and you know, and you mentioned kind of people fleeing, and I don't know if you were mixed up in our last fleeing event out of Atlanta during the whole Snowmageddon thing. I was, got to witness that, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm sitting here and as I'm listening to you, I'm thinking of our population today, you know, compared to what it was a couple hundred years ago, and there are so many people, and I mean, I could just imagine, you know, it's time to flee, and everybody hops in their cars, and we're in gridlock.
350 million people in the U.S., most of them live on the eastern seaboard. The area of blast is not going to be where the country is most densely populated. Montana is very sparsely populated. Mm-hmm. So is Colorado and Wyoming. As we get to the Midwest, again, sparsely populated. But then, so it's not going to be like half of the people are wiped out in the blast. Most of the people are going to be here. And then the ash is going to start coming. And they're going to be told, you've got to get out of the city. You've got to get out of New York and Philadelphia. And you've got to get out of Chicago now. Yep. And where are they going to go?
Well, that's a great question.
They'll stay ahead of the coming ash, mm-hmm. and the ash will be moving generally east and maybe slightly south because of the prevailing winds. And so that means that they're going to be moving east and they're going to be moving south, and they're going to be going to Florida. Yeah. I mean, that's where it's going to be the most safe.
Well, I'll tell you what, we're going to pick up right here where we left off. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and this is a very interesting topic. Stay put. We'll be right back.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, The Talk of the Town. And we are, you know, we're all about emergency preparedness. And today we're talking about the super volcanoes. And I'll tell you, Doug, I'm learning a lot today. I mean, you know, we were talking about, you know, getting up and fleeing and heading out. And when we just left off, one of the things I was going to ask you, if you know, and we talked about the ash and the way that it travels and just the amount of area that it could possibly cover. How fast does this actually move?
It depends entirely on the wind conditions and storm conditions. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's about the same as any other weather pattern that you would see. I mean, it's not going to be put at the very beginning, it's pushed by a blast. So, I mean, that would cover miles and seconds. But after the eruption and after that initial zone where, you know, everything is fried from the volcanic explosion, then it's just a weather pattern. So how long does it take for tornadoes and thunderstorms to come from Texas to Atlanta? Mm-hmm. You know, how long does it take when you hear that, you know, the storm, the big thunderstorms are over in Alabama, how long until they reach Atlanta? Well, you know, it could be 6 hours, it could be 12. So you kind of figure that it's kind of a pattern across mm-hmm. the state. You look at weather patterns from the Midwest, and when do they reach New York? Well, you know, it takes about a week. You hear about the bad storms, you know, on Monday, and by Friday they're battering the East Coast. So you're looking at from the Midwest on probably, you know, somewhere between 5 and 8 days mm-hmm. before the clouds would roll in. And that's why about 3 weeks for it to completely encircle the globe. And what it would just keep spreading around the Earth until it had completely saturated our atmosphere. And then it's going to be reflecting a large portion of the sunlight out. So it would be the exact opposite of a greenhouse effect. We would start global cooling.
And what do you have any idea how long something like this would last before things would settle down and get back to, you know, somewhat normal?
The little ice age back in the late 1700s lasted about 40 years.
Wow. That's longer than I had
Now, that's thought. That is an extreme case. I mean, it was a large, but if you had a supervolcano, it would probably put even more ash into the atmosphere. And when I say 40 years, I don't mean that that's 40 years of darkness and
right.
frozen. I mean that the temperatures had been altered from mm-hmm. normal for about that period. The worst of it was for about 10 years after the eruption.
When was the last, I guess it would be the supervolcano.
Supervolcano mm-hmm. eruption has been several hundred thousand years.
Mm.
And they are very, very rare, but they are very, very large, so they kind of get people's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Even the volcanoes like Krakatoa and Mount Pinatubo that have erupted, that have had significant effects on our atmosphere, were nothing like a supervolcano in size.
So what is it that, they sound pretty destructive. What is the deciding factor that would make a volcano a super volcano?
Pure size. If it's a mountain, that's mm-hmm. one thing. If it's an entire state that mm-hmm. disappears, that's a super volcano. Mm-hmm. The size of the magma chamber underneath determines. And most magma chambers are about the size of a mountain. I mean, you can see, a big mountain, you think, wow, that's pretty big. The one underneath Yellowstone is the size of Montana.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's the size of millions of mountains. And so that's what changes the dynamic when you have something that large start to have a magma displacement. And this is very different from the seismic activity we see having to do with like some of the earthquakes, especially the ones in Oklahoma and along the Ring of Fire. Those are seismic activities due to plate tectonics, as opposed to magma moving and causing an earthquake from magma displacement. When there are faults all over the world where these plates that form the Earth's crust move and swish around, and they're floating on a sea. All of the crust is floating on a sea of magma.
Mm-hmm.
So as they move and jiggle and get swirled around, they bump into each other and grind against each other. That causes earthquakes. That's tectonic earthquakes. That's not the same as when a fissure forms and magma is forced up through the surface to become lava, and that pushes things around and causes other earthquakes. But both types of earthquakes have devastating effects on all human structures. I mean, we kind of have this faith that the ground is solid and you can build your house on solid rock and you'll be just fine. And it's not solid at all. We are all floating on a sea of molten rock.
It's a little disturbing.
It really is. Yeah. I mean, you think about it. And just because it hasn't happened before doesn't mean it won't happen. I mean, I remember reading a story of a kid about a volcano in Mexico where it was this poor guy's field, and all of a sudden there was a crack and lava started bubbling up, and a week later there was a 1,000-foot-tall volcanic mountain where his field used to be. Mm. It just bubbled up and there it was. And that's what happened. I mean, this new island in off the coast of Japan, a week ago it wasn't there.
Mm.
And now there is a giant mountain there that's coming up from the bottom of the ocean. It just appears. You know, this is something that you can't be forewarned about. It'll just happen mm-hmm. one day. And the trick is since you can't, you're not going to get, there's bad thunderstorms coming in a couple of hours. There's bad thunderstorms coming in a couple of hours. You're not going to get that kind mm-hmm. of warning. It's just going to be suddenly, wow,
mm.
there's a big mountain there now.
Yeah. And with all the technology we have, I wonder why it is that we can't. I mean, to be honest, I just don't understand the way that the technology works as far as following these, but I'm surprised that we can't have a more...
We can monitor what's happening,
mm-hmm.
but we have no way to make predictions on where the stresses are going to build up enough to create tectonic earthquakes. And we have no idea when there's going to be enough magma or why the magma moves like it does. We don't have any clue. I mean, we don't even really know what is under the surface of the Earth. We just have a good guess based on what we can observe from here. I mean, we have a spinning iron core The reason we think that is because iron's heavy, so it would have coalesced to the bottom of the Earth when it was spinning. And we have a magnetosphere. So obviously there's something metal moving around to create this. But we don't really know. Nobody does. And so there's no way to make educated predictions on where there's going to be a volcano. I mean, if you have an active volcano, if you've seen it in the past, then you can say, you know, well, it's likely to happen again. You can measure to see if there's activity, if it's, you know, moving, if it's shaking, you can measure that. But there are dormant volcanoes, extinct volcanoes still go off with very, very little warning. Yeah. And then you have active volcanoes that are constantly doing stuff. And you can kind of sit there and go, yeah, it's coming into a period of increased activity. It may explode. It may dribble a little bit. We don't know, but it's doing something because we can see it doing something.
Yeah. Yeah, well, and you know, like you mentioned earlier on the show and talked about just sort of the flight of the birds taking off and the animals and, you know, the going in different directions. And it, I mean, it seems like just kind of going back to our natural instincts almost gives us a better idea.
You know, there you have people who have had an injury and they can tell how the barometric pressure is dropping because they can feel pain. They can feel the weather coming. Maybe some people do have that kind of sense, but I don't. I'm not going to cultivate it. I don't know how to cultivate it. So the best thing,
you could go camping for 10 days.
The best thing I can do is to have a good go bag and be ready. And, you know, the other thing is if this were to happen, I mean, if earthquakes are one thing, everybody can be, that's a localized event. And it may be, you know, devastating in the localized area, but it's only going to happen in one city or one county. You're not going to have a global event. But if a super volcano goes off and we have a global event, you're not going to be able to run forever. Eventually, it's going to catch up to you with the global cooling. It's going to catch up to you with the ash and the limited travel and the ending of air flights for probably months. So what are you going to do? You're going to have to have a kit. You're going to have a plan. And preparing for this is a lot like preparing for a biological or chemical gas attack.
Right. And, you know, one of the things, too, Doug, because, you know, I've been into emergency preparedness for some time, and what I've really realized is as different things are brought to my attention, and as there are things that, you know, there are a couple things that I have high on my radar that I'm more concerned over others. And but, you know, when you start preparing for one thing, it's almost identical for preparing for, you know, multiple things. And when you really look at, you know, your basic needs and what it is that you need, just with your food and your water. And I mean, when you do prepare, it doesn't necessarily have to be that we're concerned about this super volcano that, you know, with all the ash and that sort of thing. But although I think it is something to talk about and something to consider, will we see it in our lifetime? It's so hard to say.
Probably not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's not really going out on a limb to
I'm
say
hoping
probably
not.
Probably not. But, you know, it's interesting because a super volcano looks an awful lot like a nuclear attack, which looks an awful lot like, you know, a new disease spreading across the country. It'd be very similar. I mean, if you had a super pandemic breakout, first thing you're going to see is them shutting off air travel because they want to limit contagion. So it's kind of the same effects. And you'll see it being spread organically in the same kind of patterns that things spread through the air. So, I mean, this is kind of a big topic because, you know, it's exciting, it's scary, it's fun to talk about, but it leads us to...
It would
to
make a good movie.
It has made a good movie or three, you know, but it leads us to thinking about things in relatively easy terms. You know, I need a bag, I need medical kit, I need a gas mask, I need stuff that I can put over the cracks in my house to help keep out dust and debris and germs.
Right, and something to survive in your home for a certain amount of time once you do seal those cracks off.
Exactly.
Because you're not going to be running down to your local grocery store.
No.
In those situations.
Yeah. I mean, the other things, the implications of the ash is that you're going to have what's called lahars. These are mudslides. That's very similar, again, to having torrential rain causing the same effects. I mean, it's a good, and this is one of the reasons I brought it up, it's a good touchstone that takes us in a lot of different directions to help us realize what we need to be prepared, not just for the super volcano, but for every day. Folks, we're coming up on a commercial break. Stay tuned. We will be back to talk a little bit more about earthquakes and how to be prepared.
And now, back to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy.
Welcome back. You're listening to Ready Radio. We're sponsored by True Prep, and we're all about emergency preparedness, getting ready. And today we're talking about the super volcanoes and earthquakes. Some of the things, like with a super volcano, not something you see every single day. But, we have in the past talked about, financial collapse, and we've talked about, like maybe an EMP and a grid failure. And, there's so many things, Doug, that we see as, some things are probable, some things are possible, and today...
Some things are just fun to think about.
Are just fun to talk about.
The zombies.
Right. Yes. Yeah, the zombie thing, too.
We talked about all of this, but, whether it's a remote possibility, a definite probability, like tornado season, just an oddball thing like zombies, all of them come back to the central theme that you have the ability to get ready for this, that you can take care of yourself, that you can be independent, that you're not going to be relying on government handouts to get through when the emergency strikes, because you're going to have your ducks in a row.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And I mean, my whole thing is, I would much rather be self-sufficient than government dependent.
Absolutely.
Because there's just more of us than there are them.
So what are you going to do to prepare for a super volcano or any other kind of airborne disaster?
Personally, I'm going to tie this in with what I usually do, with a lot of the things that I do prepare for. One of the things I don't think we really talked a whole lot about yet, Doug, was just kind of your medical supplies and, what we would need in, we could talk about this as far as this being the scenario that we're preparing for. If there were, these shards of
volcanic
horrible
ash,
drifting through the atmosphere. I mean, we're talking about different filters. Maybe that would be something that I would look at that I don't usually have for maybe, say, a financial collapse.
Right.
Like air filters.
Air filters, gas masks, and even just plastic sheeting, being able to get some duct tape and plastic sheeting. But, there are other disasters besides the super volcano that call for plastic sheeting around windows. That's contagion, and not only contagion, but chemical warfare, and even just simple things like being able to, lock out contaminants that are flowing in through the area. So,
right.
I mean, you could have a train derailment that causes a gas leak that would be best suited by plastering your windows with sheets of plastic and making your home relatively, leak-proof.
Right. And I'm thinking, kind of visual, and I'm a very visual person, but I'm visualizing if I'm, locking myself in my home and I've got, duct tape on all of the little seals and things like this. I'm assuming I'm not going out, or at least that's not my plan.
Right.
So since my plan is not to go out, I'm not making grocery store stops. I'm, if water is not coming out of my faucet, I need, some sort of water source. And so, just like with other preparations that I'm doing, food and water.
And this would be a perfect time for the water bob, because the water bob, it's not that you're going to be instantly out of water in 10 seconds, it's that you're going to need to store water. So you can put 100 gallons in each bathtub in your house. I mean, I have two bathtubs, so there's 200 gallons, a gallon of water per person per day. That's, 200 days worth of water, or if you divide it by four for a family of four, about 2 months' supply of water.
Yeah, yeah, and if our listeners, if you're not familiar with a water bob, check it out on True Prep's website, just TruePrep, TruePrep.com. The water bob really is pretty nifty. I really like this thing, Doug, because what you're using, you're actually utilizing your bathtub to store the water, but this thing is actually a bladder that goes inside your bathtub. I like this because, my bathtub is not always clean. I hate to admit that, but it's true. I mean, not necessarily mine, but like my teenager's bathtub, because they're in charge of cleaning their own bathtubs. But anyway, so I mean, if your bathtub's not terribly clean. Also, Doug, we have pets. I have a dog. Right now, my dog is shedding, and I don't necessarily want my dog shedding hair in my drinking water. So,
and you don't necessarily want your dog getting thirsty and going and drinking
right.
a couple of gallons.
Oh my gosh, she already drinks out of the toilet. It's bad enough. Yeah, exactly.
Which is why you need a Berkey too, so that you can filter out all of that stuff that's floating in your water. even if you put it in the water, Bob, you're still going to have stuff in your water.
Oh, not necessarily. This thing actually, if you've seen it, it has a pump on the top, so you can actually pump the water out, of the top, and it's awesome.
So there, I mean, there's a lot of things that are going to go into this that we need. I mean, we're going to have the same food and water requirements. Mm-hmm. Medical is going to be a big deal. You're going to have a lot of people dealing with medical issues in this type of disaster. So it's good to have a real medical kit. I mean, a lot of people, I read a statistic just the other week that 53% of Americans do not have a first aid kit in their house.
You mean not even Band-Aids?
53%, no kit.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's really startling. I think that, you know, a kit would involve not only bandages, but also an antiseptic and probably, you know, something that you could use to adhere to close up a wound. So just basic things, but most people don't have it. By definition, most people don't have that.
Yeah.
And that's just the basics. You really need to have a lot more in your kit than that. You should have tape. You should have surgical shears that you can use to cut things, you know, cut clothing off somebody without the danger of cutting into them.
Mm-hmm.
You should have, you know, ace wrap. You should have antiseptic ointments, and you should have rubbing alcohol, and you should have hydrogen peroxide, and you should have, you know, gauze so that you can clean wounds. I'm not exactly up to the level of being able to do sutures, but our guest next week is going to be Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy.
Yay.
Who are going to talk a little bit about emergency medicine, both in the field and after disaster. So, I mean, this dovetails in nicely to the next phase, which is learning how to do things.
Yes, you know, and one of the things that I've recently added to my medical kit is I have a great reference book. I mean, I've had a couple little things here and there, but I really did find a good reference book that I can physically use because I'm not a surgeon. Honestly, if I had to stitch someone up, I would probably throw up a couple times. I mean, or pass out. But you know, if you have a good reference book on things that you know could possibly happen and things that you can actually do. You know, it's worth its weight in gold.
I've seen on Twitter several times, and I think we retweeted the link where you can get Where There Is No Doctors as a PDF file for free download.
Oh,
I mean,
awesome.
That's a fantastic reference. Now, of course, you'd like to have a hard copy in an emergency, but
yes.
Just something that you can look at and read through on your off time on your phone. I mean, it's a great resource. There's lots of things like this. And getting ready and getting prepared is more than just, you know, buying some supplies. It's about getting the knowledge. And True Prep is a home of the most knowledgeable staff who can help guide you through this, where you're making your intelligent decisions and they teach you how to use the items that you're procuring.
Right. It's so important that, you know, with emergency preparedness, and I learn stuff every day, Doug. We went on a big camping trip this last weekend, and I learned that my bug out bag is a little too heavy. So we actually went on this camping trip to, you know, play with the things that we have in our get home bag. I like to call mine more my get home bag because I'm not really planning on bugging out per se. You know, I'm going to try to bug in, you know, the best I can, depending on the situation. If my house is on fire, I will bug out. But I learned.
Or if there's a big chemical or
yeah.
biological attack. I mean, you know, all of Atlanta, anybody to the east of Atlanta is going to be right in the wind path for anything that happens there. Nuclear, anything like that is going to have a path straight due east. I mean, if you lived way up in like Rome, you might escape it. Or if you're down past Macon, maybe. But all of us in the metro area are going to have problems.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, that's just one of those reasons that it's just so important, you know, to practice with things. Now, do you have how many rolls of duct tape do you have at your house?
I think right now I've got a whole pack of six of them, if I'm thinking right, which would probably be just about enough to do plastic sheeting over my windows. And I actually do have plastic sheeting at this time, which is rare, but it happens to be in the garage right now for another project. You know, it as we look at what we can amass, there's lots of everyday things that make a difference. I wanted to touch also that, you know, as we're talking about ways to get ready and the knowledge, you know, True Prep has such knowledgeable people, but you can pick up information from Preppers Talk on Twitter, and you can visit our Twitter. We're at Ready Radio Net on Twitter. We have a website, readyradio.net, where you can listen to old shows or comment on our blogs or send us an email at info@readyradio.net. We're also on Facebook, and we're here trying to keep a good amount of content there, sharing stories that would be of interest to our listeners so that you can get a lot of information about preparedness and current events and news, things that are going on in the world from our different media outlets.
Yeah. I would also like to really challenge our listeners. I'm really, you know, we're still fairly new, you know, on the air. Gosh, how long have we been doing this now, Doug? A couple months, I guess?
I think we're up to 7.
7 months?
Yeah.
Boy, how time flies. That's awesome. Well, I really do hope that every time that we broadcast, I really do want to challenge our listeners to, you know, not just, you know, don't just listen. Don't, you know, just be, you know, Doug, of course, is very entertaining, you know, but this isn't just for entertainment. I love the looks that he gives me, but just, you know, I want to challenge you to do something. I don't care what it is, something. Go and pick up an extra can, you know, of green beans if it's on sale. Just something if you haven't started.
And you know, the journey of 1,000 miles begins with one step. Mm-hmm. That can,
yes,
of green beans will lead you onto a path of being more self-sufficient, less reliant, more independent, more of a complete person. Mm-hmm. Than anything else that will ever affect your life. I mean, you can't suddenly go to being Les Stroud. It doesn't happen overnight.
No, it doesn't.
But you know what does happen overnight? Getting started.
Yeah, it does. And here's the thing, too. I have met people who haven't started just because the sole reason it's overwhelming. You know, if you are overwhelmed and you really do need help to get on the right path, that's another great reason to go visit the people at True Prep.
We do these things not because they are easy, but because they are hard. They're necessary. They are what make us who we are. Go to True Prep, visit their website, listen to us, listen to all the other, you know, media information outlets that get us, you know, more ready for what's coming. Folks, it's been a great show. I appreciate you listening. Tune in next week for Dr. Bones and Nurse Amy, who are going to be talking about how to be prepared medically in an emergency. You're listening to Ready Radio on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.
You've been listening to Ready Radio with Doug and Amy. It's emergency preparedness for everyone. Brought to you by True Prep. For all your prepping needs, visit True Prep online at truprep.com or visit a True Prep store in Roswell or Marietta. Tune in each week as Doug and Amy get you ready for anything that comes your way. Ready Radio, Saturday evenings at 5, only on News Talk 1160, the talk of the town.